Breslin takes a deep breath and blows it out slowly, so we can see how much he's putting into keeping his temper with us. "Okay," he says. "Okay, let's go ahead and spend some time picturing it."
"Thanks," Steve says, giving him a humble smile. "I appreciate that."
Rory shows up with his shitty Tesco bouquet. Aisling, who clearly wasn't the shitty Tesco type, isn't happy. She gets snotty. Rory's not having that. He's been blowing his budget and rearranging his schedule and racing around Stonybatter in the rain to make her happy. But that's not good enough for Princess Special. He pulls out a Jane Austen quote about high-maintenance bitches, or prick teases, or whatever literary types call girls like that. Aisling slaps him down hard. She tells him exactly why he's not good enough for her, including why she hasn't let him into her knickers and why after this she never will. She goes one put down too far and bam! Breslin mimes a little punch, not bothering to put much into it. And here we all are. Can you picture that? Okay. Yeah?
That'll work. All right. Steve nods, picturing away.
Only you'd think the bouquet would get a bit messed up, like, in all the action. He'd drop it or something. We didn't find any petals on the floor. So no petals happen to come off. Or Rory's got the brains to pick them up. We're not talking about a massive struggle. We're talking a bit of that. Breslin makes a yappy mouth sign. One punch and a few seconds of oh shit. A couple of petals would have been great, but in this job, you can't get too demanding. You need to work with what you've got instead of fussing about what you haven't. Breslin's giving Steve the beginnings of a smile, all ready to kiss and make up. Am I right or am I right? Steve says cheerfully, "You're dead right, man. I'd just like to shake a few more trees, see if anything falls out is all." When Breslin rears away, rolling his jaw. "I'm new, you know. I've got loads to learn. Might as well get into practice while I can." "Oh, you're not that fucking new. You've both been on the job long enough that you should be able to handle your own cases without a babysitter. This kind of shit right here is why the gaffer decided you need one. And we appreciate you taking on the job, man, seriously. But I've got to get there in my own time. Know what I mean? Otherwise, I'll never learn. Sure. What harm?" "Moron. Come on. The harm is that you two are about to embarrass yourselves. And let's be honest here. It's not like you can afford to do that. If you actually let this guy walk out of here while you go shaking trees or whatever it was, you look weak as fuck. You look unsure. And not just to the rest of us. The longer you leave it, the more the defense is going to make of it. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, even the cops weren't positive my client was guilty. How can you not share their reasonable doubt? Doesn't that bother you at all?" In the interview room, Rory lifts his head and wipes his face with the heels of his hands. He's red and blotchy. The tears are there. For whatever that's worth. Steve raises his cup to Breslin. "Don't worry, man. We'll make sure the gaffer knows you did your best to light a fire under us."
"Whoa there. Hang on a second. You think this is about me?"
Breslin switches to a nice mix of stunned and wounded.
"You seriously think that's what I'm worried about? My rep?"
"Ah, God, no," Steve says, giving him a big sweet smile. "Your rep's amazing. Stellar. Is that the word I'm looking for?"
"It'd take more than the likes of us to mess it up. I'm just saying, don't worry. We'll make sure credit goes where credit's due. This isn't about me. I don't work like that.
This isn't even about you. If it was just your reps on the line, then sure. I'd try to stop you making a hames of this for your own sakes. But in the end, I'd have to let you make your own choices. This is about the squad.
If you take a month to get up the balls to charge Mr. Obvious in there, the media won't be yelling about how Conway and Moore need to get their act together. They'll be yelling about how the murder squad needs to start taking his job seriously and actually protecting the public from scumbags. I'm hoping you two have at least enough loyalty to give a damn about that. Breslin's worked himself up into enough of a righteous lather that I can't tell whether he actually thinks he means that shite. I say, how's the squad gonna look if we charge the wrong guy?
Having to drop the charges, Steve says, doing a cringe face.
Public apology, more than likely. Media yelling about how the murder squad's a share of incompetent wankers who don't care who they lock up as long as they get the solve. Witnesses afraid to come to us in case they end up in cuffs because we're in such a hurry to charge anyone we can get our hands on. He shakes his head. Not good, man. For the squad, like.
Breslin sighs again. Conway, Moran, he says, changing tack to go gentle. The guy is guilty as sin. Take it from someone who was putting scumbags away when you two were kids filling out your application forms for Temple Moore. He's our man. The question here isn't whether he did it. The question is whether you two are able to do what needs doing.
I say, we'll all just have to keep our fingers crossed, won't we?
Okay, listen. Breslin leans back against the wall, gives us both the smile that melts witnesses. I know you guys haven't been getting an easy ride around here. Probably you thought I'd missed that, or didn't care. But you'd be surprised how many of us are pulling for you. I've always said you'll make a great pair of murder deeds once you find your feet.
Thanks, man, Steve says.
Steve gets basically no hassle, except what rubs off on me. Breslin just wants the pair of us paranoid. That means a lot.
Not a problem. You've just got to get past the routine bullshit. Newbies get hazed. You know, it's part of the job. It's not personal.
The slimy bastard is too thick to realise he used the same words to Rory Fallon 5 minutes back. Or else he thinks we are. And he thinks we're thick enough to believe our shit pile is just routine. Or desperate enough to pretend we do. The lads just need to see whether you can take the heat. And this?
Breslin points at the one-way glass. This is your chance to show them.
I know all the silly shite has to have knocked your confidence. But if school kid crap can take you to the point where you don't trust your own judgment enough to charge a slam dunk like this one, maybe you'd be better off back in blue.
Yeah? That sounds harsh.
Lifting a hand like one of us tried to break in, which we didn't.
But it's what you need to hear.
I know better than to look at Steve. In the corner of my eye, he's still peacefully swinging his legs and drinking his water. But I can feel him knowing better than to look at me. Breslin wants us to charge Rory Fallon. He wants it badly. It could be because he's sick of babysitting the kindergarten case. Wants to wind it up and go back to his pal McCann and their PhD-level fancy conspiracies and gang boss shootings. Could be because he wants to shake himself in front of O'Kelly. It took those two a month to crack their last domestic. With me on board, it takes them a day. Now give my ego a handjob and put me up for promotion. Could be just that he's so in the habit of arm twisting. He can't get through his day without that buzz. But I've been taking it for granted that whoever threw me to Crowley did it on the spur of the moment, for kicks. Like whoever dropped my phone in my coffee back when I still left it on my desk. It didn't occur to me till this moment that a lot more thought could have gone into it. Creepy Crowley is whipping this case up into a big one, and someone is egging him on. If I fuck up spectacularly, like, for example, if I charge Fallon when there's some great big chunk of exonerating evidence that somehow managed to vanish on its way to my desk, and if the papers somehow happen to get hold of the story, the whole country will explode with it. And there'll be the excuse the squad's gagging for. I'll be gone. In an interview, this is where I'd be on my feet, stopping the tape. Interview paused at 2:52 p.m. Detectives Conway and Morn leaving the interview room and getting me and Steve the hell out of there. We need a chat. Right now. I watch Breslin blandly and wait to see what comes next.
Here's what we'll do, Breslin says. Morn, you go have a look through the CCTV. See if you can pick up Rory Fallon leaving the Vic's place last night and track him through town. Maybe we can figure out where he ditched the gloves. Meanwhile, Conway and I will have another go at Rory, try for confession. Shouldn't be a problem to us, am I right?
He gives me a big pally grin and I swear to God, an actual clap on the shoulder. I nearly punched the presumptuous fucker.
Even if we don't get it, no big deal. We've got plenty on him already. We arrest him, charge him. I get to tell the lads that when the chips are down, you two can do the business. And I can pretty much guarantee you won't be getting any more hassle in the squad room. Everyone's a happy camper.
He's a hair away from spelling it out for us.
You go along with me on this, and I'll sort out the lads for you.
This isn't just because he wants to get back to McCann, or because he wants to look pretty for the gaffer. He's itching to get Fallon charged, and he's positive we're going to jump on the deal. He's already tightening his tie and heading for the door.
I say, here's what we'll do. DC and Staunton are making a list of Rory Fallon's KAs. If Rory's our boy, then the guy who called it in will be on that list. I'd like you to have chats with them all. See if you can identify the caller. Start with the best mates and brothers, if he's got them. If there's no joy there, you can work your way down.
Breslin has turned around. He's staring at me, but he's managing to stay nice and neutral, ready to keep the matey stuff coming if we let him. When he's sure I'm done, he says,
"Why?"
I say, "Because me and Detective Moran will take Fallon from here." Breslin looks back and forth between us. He's aiming for the big dog who's been patient with the bold puppies long enough. But him having to look up at us takes some of the oomph out of it. He says,
"I'm going to need an explanation here."
I'm opening my mouth on, "Because this is our fucking case, and the next time you try to give me an order, you're getting a knee in the balls." But Steve gets in there first. He says,
"You're dead right, man. We need to earn the lad's respect. And that's not going to happen if you get our confession first. We appreciate the offer, but we're going to handle this one ourselves."
Which I have to admit is better than my version. The second of taking aback on Breslin's face gives me my control back. I tell Steve,
"Detective Breslin knows that, you tickle. Does he look like a rookie to you? He was testing us. He was trying to see if we'd wimp out and offload the tough stuff on someone else when we got the chance, or if we've got the nads to actually do our job."
Steve's mouth opens, then he bursts out laughing.
"Jesus, and me standing here like an idiot, giving you the big speech about earning the lad's respect. Fair play to you, man. You have me going all right."
Breslin's got a bit of a smile on his mouth, but those pale eyes still moving back and forth between us are cold and expressionless. He doesn't know whether he believes us or not. I let myself crack a half grin.
"You have me too, of course. There's a reason he's got that stellar rep." "Thanks, Breslin. If we get the message loud and clear, we'll do our job. And once we've done it, we'll see it in the instant room. Case meeting at 4.
I give him a pleasant nod and turn away to the one-way glass. Overlaid on Rory, Breslin's reflection stays still, staring at me. My back prickles. Then he shrugs.
I'd love to think you know what you're doing, he says. See you at 4.
The reflection turns and vanishes. The observation room door clicks shut. Me and Steve wait, listening, watching Rory fumble in his pocket and find a crumpled tissue and try to mop up the mess that's his face. Then I go to the door and open it fast. The corridor is empty. Steve says, I don't like this. His accent's gone back to normal. I say, me neither. What's he playing at? I don't know. I leave the door open. I'm trying to pace, but the observation room is too small. Every 2 steps, I'm slamming off a wall. The stink has thickened till it's like another person in there, shoving us aside. Did you hear him? I can guarantee you won't get any more hassle in the squad room. He was trying to bribe us. What would he want, Fallon charged? This badly? I don't know. I didn't think he was one of the ones trying to fuck me up. Steve has to see what goes down. What with not being in a coma. But I don't do heart-to-hearts. This is the first time I've talked about this shit straight out. And it doesn't feel good. But if we charge Fallon too soon, and then it all goes tits up, and Crowley splatters it all over the country. Even the thought, the burst of applause in the squad room, the smirk on Roach, the naked relief in O'Kelly's voice as he explains that this isn't working out, sends red zigzags across my brain. I say, that'd be one way to put me out of commission. Steve has split his plastic water cup and is folding it into shapes. He says, it could be just that. Him trying to fuck us up. The us is cute. No one's on any campaign to fuck Steve up. But it gives me a quick ridiculous beat of warmth anyway. I've never got that vibe off him either, but I always got the sense he doesn't give a monkey's about us either way. Me too. But if he was serious about getting rid of us, that's exactly the sense we would get. Breslin's no genius, but he's been at this a long time. He's well able to hide what he's at. Or, Steve says, if the gangster thing pans out. He leaves it there. The sharp crack of folding plastic jabs me in the ear. Bent cops exist. Fewer in real life than on the telly, but they're out there. Everything from the guy squaring a speeding fine in exchange for match tickets to the guy who's owned by a gang boss, body and soul. If a gangster boyfriend killed Aisling, the first thing he or his pals would do is ring their best bitch boy and tell him to sort it out. The perfect way to sort it out, no loose ends, no worries, would be charging Rory Fallon and closing the case. Breslin, I say. I've stopped pacing, stopped breathing almost. Breslin? You think? Seriously? Steve lifts one shoulder. Nah, I don't see it. He's all about being the big hero. He wouldn't be able to handle seeing himself as the bad guy's pet cop. It'd blow his brain cells. Steve says, Breslin would find a way to see himself as the hero no matter what he did. That's where he starts, with the idea that he's the good guy. So whatever he's doing must be right. Then he works backwards from there to figure out how. Which is true, but I never thought about it that way before. I've never spent this much time thinking anything about Breslin before. I don't like the feel it gives me, clamped onto the back of my neck. What Steve's talking about? It's not just Breslin who thinks that way. We all do. When you badger a statement out of some traumatized witness, or manipulate a mother into giving evidence that'll put her own kid in jail, you get to enjoy the buzz of winning without tying yourself in knots over the deeper moral subtleties, because you're the good guy in this story. Steve is shredding that into something different, something tangled and thorny, dangerous. He says, and he's the type they go for. Wife, kids, mortgage. The gang boys don't bother with the likes of me and Steve. Working class singles on the way up. Unless there's a gambling problem or a coke habit, we don't come with enough leverage. But Breslin has a high maintenance blonde wife and 3 buck-tooth blonde boys. Like something out of an ad. And a house in a snazzy part of Temple Oak. That's a lot of needs tugging at his sleeves. And a lot to lose if he were to change his mind down the line. Once he was in, even one toe, he wouldn't be getting out. Breslin and McCann pull a lot of the big gang murders. They spend a lot of their time talking to seriously hardcore guys. It would be a miracle if somewhere along the way someone hadn't made Breslin an offer. That same flex to the air that I felt in the squad room. Straight lines buckling at the edges of my eyes. My heart is going hard. I say, yeah, he is. Exactly the type. And a murder do would be worth top dollar to a gang boss. Breslin wears good suits. But we all do. He drives a 2014 BMW. And he bangs on about how his kids go to private school because he's not having them surrounded by scangers and immigrants who can barely speak English. And that's just the scangers. Ha ha ha. No offense, Conway. Moron. But I always figured Daddy and Mummy were bankrolling him. He takes his family to the Maldives for holidays. But if I cared enough to think about it, I would have assumed he'd squared a few penalty points for his bank manager in exchange for a sky-high credit card limit and no pressure to pay it off. Me and Steve have been wanting an interesting case. This could be a lot more interesting than we bargained for. Steve says, and if he's the one who fed Crowley his info, that would explain why. Enough mud in the water can take you a long way towards reasonable doubt. The air twitches in the corners, and I can't keep the grin off my face. If Steve's right, then there's some high-level danger headed our way from a bunch of directions at once. Gangs don't kill cops. It would draw too much hassle. But they don't have a problem firebombing your car to tell you to back off. And that's small time compared to what the lads will do if we dob Breslin into internal affairs. I can't wait for them all to bring it on. Danger doesn't bother me. I'll eat danger with a spoon. Breslin, the puffed up little tosspot, trying to twist me like a balloon animal. He made me feel like I was in a straitjacket and writhing to punch him. But Breslin, the bent cop, he's a dare. A bad poison dare that no one with sense should take. And I've always had a thing for dares. Steve's eyeing me like I've lost it. What? What's funny? Nothing. I like a challenge. So you think I'm right? You think he's... Steve doesn't finish. That sobers me up a notch. I don't know yet. We're way into the hypothetical here. I don't like hypotheticals. I bite down on one thumb to get rid of the grin. All we know for definite is Breslin wants this guy charged and the case closed. ASAP. We need to stall till we've got a handle on why. What you came up with back there about doing our own dirty work, that was good. That should buy us some time. The twist to Steve's mouth doesn't look convinced. You think he went for it? Not sure. I think so. I hope so. The memory of Breslin's cold stare makes me bite down harder. Either way, that's the line we stick to. We're the thick old rookies who don't get how things work around here. And we want to do our case our way. Are you okay with that? Part of me expects Steve to squirm away. There's a decent chance that the bullshit here is all about me. As long as he plays it right,
He can sidestep the blast and slot right into the squad once I'm a smoking crater. But he'll blow his chance if he convinces Breslin he's an idiot. But he grins. I can manage to go rookie. Right up your alley, I say. The relief hits me harder than I want to think about. No action required. Hey, you use what you've got. Steve tilts a thumb at the one-way glass. What do we do with him? Rory has finished his cry. He's getting antsy, popping his head up to peer worriedly around, like a specky meerkat wondering where we've disappeared to. He should be the biggest thing in our day. I practically forgot he existed. I say, we have one more go, like we told Breslin we would. That means leaving Breslin to talk to his KAs. You think that's safe? If Breslin's looking to fuck up either Rory or me, there are a dozen ways that Rory's pals could be a pure gift to him. I say, probably not, but what the hell? Let's live dangerously. It was the only way I could think of to get rid of him, and I don't want him in with Fallon any longer. Fallon can't take being pushed around. If Breslin shoves him anymore, he's going to walk. And whether he's our guy or not, I don't want him thinking we're big scary bullies out to get him. Not yet, anyway. Whether or not, Steve says. You're not sure anymore? I lift one shoulder. I was when I came out of there. Not 100%, but almost. There's something dodgy about him getting to Stonybatter early. He didn't like talking about it. Did you spot that? Yeah. But the reaction when you told him Aisling was dead, that looked real to me. To me too. But even if it was, that doesn't say he's innocent. Rory's got his sodden tissue between finger and thumb, and he's looking around for somewhere to put it. He gives up and tucks it in his pocket. I say, he might not have known he'd killed her. He throws the punch. She goes down. But when he checks her pulse or her breathing, she's still alive. So he turns off the cooker to make sure the place won't burn down around her, and he legs it. He thinks she's just got a concussion or whatever. He spends the night praying it's knocked the memory right out of her head. And when he finds out she's dead, and all of a sudden he's staring down the barrel of a murder charge, he nearly shits himself. That'd play, Steve says. When I came out of there, I would have put money on it. But now, Rory half stands up and sits down again, like standing might not be allowed. I say, you? Steve runs a thumbnail along the ribbing of the plastic cup and watches Rory try to stay sitting. The thing is, even if Rory is our guy, that doesn't mean there's no secret gangster boyfriend. And Breslin's clean. His voice goes down on that. We both glance automatically at the door. Nothing. Assume the boyfriend exists, right? Even if he did nothing to Aisling, he isn't going to want us sniffing around his business, checking his movements, telling his missus about his bit on the side. The second he finds out Aisling's dead, if he calls round to her for a quickie late last night, say, he's going to put in a call to his guy on the inside and tell him to get it sorted fast. And the slower we get it sorted, I say, the longer we've got to find out if there's something else going on. Just saying the words lifts my heart rate. So we stall, Steve says. Not stall. Breslin's right. We don't need a rep for getting nothing done. We'll just take it nice and easy. Whatever's going on here, I don't want Rory back in till we know every single thing we can get about this case. If we go at him again, I want us going in with enough ammo to blow him away. Steve nods. And right now? I check my watch, just under an hour till the case meeting. Right now, we take him through a story again,
see if he's got anything he wants to tell us, get his coat and gloves, try and convince him to let us go through his flat. Then we send him home and do this case meeting. After that, we get some fucking sleep. I'm wrecked. Saying it pulls a huge yawn out of him. I bite one back, but too late. It's hit me that I'm shattered too. My vision is jumping. I can't tell how far away the walls are. But Breslin's not, I say. If we go home, we're leaving him in charge to do whatever he wants. And if we don't, we're tipping him off. Steve's right. For a dead kid or a dead cop, you work 24 hours straight if you need to, then grab a shower and a quick kip and head in for another 24. If you do that for every case, you'll burn out inside 3 months. Your basic murder gets an 8-hour shift, maybe 12 or 14 if something interesting happens. If me and Steve go 24 hours for this, we might as well run to Breslin and tell him we think there's something dodgy going on. I say, so what do we do about him? Load him up with busy work at the case meeting. Keep him out of trouble. Yeah, right. He'd love that. Big man like him. Steve's grinning. This isn't about his ego, remember? He told us so. It's all about the squad. He won't mind tracking down every passenger on the 39A. Not when it's for the squad. I'm grinning too. Search every bin between Stony Batter and Ranelagh, Breslin, for the sake of the squad. Go to the postmortem, Breslin, for the sake of the squad. Type up statements. Pizza run, Breslin, for the sake of the squad. We're both on the edge of a full-on fit of the giggles. If I relax that much, I'm going to fall asleep right here on my feet. We'll keep him on checking out Fallon, I say. If he gets through the KAs, he can talk to Fallon's old girlfriends, see if he's got any history of giving out the slaps. He won't have. Steve runs his hand under the water cooler tap and over his face, trying to wake himself up. Probably not. But if Breslin wants Fallon charged this bad, he won't have a problem digging for dirt on him, right? That should keep him too busy to make trouble for us. At least for the evening. And we'll send a floater with him. Might make him think twice before he disappears any statement he doesn't like. There must be something in my voice. Steve glances up sharply. Has more stuff been going missing on you since that witness on the Petrescu case, like? Nah, I say. I'm not about to sob on his shoulder about the mean boys who stole my lovely statement sheet. But that doesn't mean it won't. We need to be careful here. Steve is still watching me, palming drops of water off his jaw. And I feel like it's half a blink too long before he answers. But he says, easily enough, a floater won't stop Breslin from feeding Crowley info, if he's the one doing it. I know that. What's your plan? You're going to follow him into the jacks, make sure he doesn't text Crowley with one hand while he's got his dick in the other? Nah, the floater's a good idea. We can tell Breslin he needs mentoring. That gets a snort out of me. He'll eat that up. It might not work. Breslin'll probably wrap the guy round his finger, but it's better than nothing. Steve says, we need to keep Breslin away from Aisling's electronics. Her phone, her emails, her social media accounts, the places where, if there is a gangster boyfriend, there might be something to point us his way. At the case meeting, we'll make sure everyone knows we've got those, I say. Breslin's probably already had a look through her phone when he went to the scene. But there's nothing good on there as far as I could tell. Tell you what else we need to do, Steve says. We need to have chats with Breslin whenever we get the chance. Or let him chat to us more like. Ah, oh, Jesus. Shoot me now. We do. Get him talking. He's not an idiot, but... But he loves the sound of his own voice, I say. Yeah, let him knock himself out enlightening us. You never know what might slip out. Chats with McCann too, if the chance comes up. McCann and Breslin have been partnering for 10 years. They're tight. If Breslin wants Rory Fallon done, for whatever reason, or if he just wants this case to blow up in my face, McCann'll know. Not that he's much of a talker, but you never know. It's the best we can do. We definitely can't talk to organised crime now. Not up front. Steve is biting a cuticle, staring at Rory without seeing him. You said you've got a mate in there. Can you get onto him? See if he's heard anything. Yeah, it's not that simple. I wet my palm at the water cooler and run it around my neck. I'll see what I can do. And we don't type anything up. God no, or leave anything on our desks. I think about my statements, locked in my desk drawer. No one's going to bother screwing with those again. They like mixing it up to keep me on my toes. But all of a sudden, the diddy little lock feels like a joke. Or in the desk drawers. Notes stay on us. Steve bites down on the corner of his lip. He says, Jesus. This is all a load of nothing. Shadows that could be thrown by something huge. Or by something barely worth tracking down. But the adrenaline is banging through me. And I can't help loving it. I almost flick water at Steve. The face on you. Cheer up, man. This could be the best bit of action we've ever seen. This isn't my kind of action. Hiding stuff from our own squad. Chillax on the jacks, I say. It's probably all a load of shite, like I said. Just being careful. Movement in the corridor. I'm at the door in two long steps, but it's just Winters walking an unimpressed little prick in a tracksuit to one of the other interview rooms. All the same. We better move, I say, before Breslin comes back to check up on us. Steve nods and tosses his mangled cup into the bin. I take one more look at Rory, who by this point is jittering like his chair is electrified. Then we head in to take it nice and easy for a while. The interview room stinks of sweat and crying. Detectives Conway and Moran entering the interview room. I tell the video recorder. Hi, Steve says, taking a seat and giving Rory a sympathetic grin. Detective Breslin had to head off. I'll be joining you instead. Detective Moran. Rory barely nods. I say, pulling up my chair, how are you doing? I'm all right. His nose is stuffed up. Sorry for... Not a problem, I say. Are you okay to talk now? Rory gives me a red-eyed accusing stare. He says, you knew all along that I've been seeing Aisling. That I was going to her house last night. You knew. Bless his middle-class little heart. He's genuinely miffed that officers of the force would deceive him. I say, yeah, we did. I know that was a shitty thing to do to you. But we're investigating a murder here. And sometimes the only way to get the info we need is by doing things that aren't ideal. If we'd told you what was up, you might have gone cagey on us, and we couldn't risk that. You might know something vital, even if you don't realise it. I've told you everything I know. He's actually in a sulk with me. I sit back in my chair and glance at Steve, handing over. You think you have? Steve says. But that was before you knew what's happened. What I've found is... A shock like that, it can shake people's memories loose. Could you do me a favour and have another think back over last night? Just in case. Rory looks him over suspiciously. But nice boy next door gives him an earnest, hopeful gaze back. And Rory decides my bad behaviour isn't Steve's fault. He's all primed to like Steve anyway. Just for not being Breslin. I suppose. I'm pretty sure there wasn't.
Ah, brilliant, Steve says.
Even the smallest thing could help us out. Did you notice anyone you can describe while you were in Stony Batter? Hear anything odd? Anything at all stand out to you?
Not really. I'm not very observant to begin with. And last night I was concentrating on Aisling. I wasn't really paying attention to anything else.
Oh yeah, I've been there. When you're just starting a relationship, especially one that's taken off like yours was. Nothing else even exists.
Steve is smiling, and it pulls a twitch that's almost a smile out of Rory.
That's it exactly. You know what the weather was like yesterday? It was a rotten evening. I was freezing. A tree dumped rain down the back of my collar. But I felt like I was in a wonderful story. The smell of turf smoke and the rain falling through the light of the street lamps.
See, that's what I'm talking about. You remember more than you thought.
And you were in Stony Batter for a full hour, right? 7:30 to 8:30. You must have seen someone.
And there's it again. The sudden involuntary twist to Rory's neck. The jab at his glasses.
Steve brings up that extra time, and all of a sudden Rory doesn't like this game. That blood smell hits the back of my nose again. The lift of Steve's head tells me he smells it too.
Rory's memory comes back. Anything to distract us.
I did, actually. I passed 3 women on Prussia Street when I was on my way to Tesco. They were dressed like they were going out. And 2 of them had hair like Aisling's, long and blonde and straight. That's why I noticed them. They were sharing an umbrella and laughing. And when I got off the bus, there were a bunch of boys in hoodies kicking a football on Astrid Road, around the corner from Aisling's house. They didn't stop when I got close, so I had to step onto the street and dodge around them. But I don't see how any of them could be.
Steve nods away, like this is crucial info.
You never know. They might have seen something. It's all good stuff.
I scribble it in my notebook. Crucial info style. There's a decent chance all these people are imaginary.
Anyone else? Anything else?
Rory shakes his head. Steve waits, but nothing else pops out.
Okay, he says. What about your conversations with Aisling?
Take a second and think back over those.
Did she ever mention anyone who bothered her?
Someone at work who was a bit creepy, maybe? An ex who wouldn't take no for an answer?
Rory is shaking his head.
Okay. Was there anything that seemed to make her uncomfortable?
She ever get a bit cagey when any particular subject came up?
Actually, Rory has relaxed again, now that we've moved away from the hot spot.
Yes, when it came to her parents. Aisling was... something was odd. She told me they were both dead. She said her dad died in a car accident when she was little, and her mum had MS for a long time, and finally died of it a few years back.
He glances back and forth between us, hoping we'll give him a yes or a no. We don't.
But she seemed very uncomfortable talking about it, and she changed the subject straight away. It could have been just because we didn't know each other that well yet. But I wondered if maybe there was more to the story. Like if one of them was still alive, but with some problem. Like I said, I mean, obviously I wasn't about to ask, but I wondered.
This isn't what Steve's angling for.
Right, he says. Interesting. We'll definitely check it out.
Anything else? Rory shakes his head. That's the only thing I can think of.
You're positive.
I'm not joking. Any little thing could make a difference. Anything.
There's a moment's silence. Rory catches his breath to say something. Then he lets it out again.
He isn't looking at Steve anymore. Steve waits, watching him, easy and interested as a pal in a pub. Rory says suddenly and unwillingly,
I just wish I knew what else you're not telling me.
Course you do, Steve says matter-of-factly. All I can say is, we don't keep things back just for the laugh. We're doing it to catch the person who killed Aisling.
Rory's eyes come up with an effort to meet Steve's. He asks,
am I a suspect?
And he braces himself for the answer.
Steve says, right now, everyone who had any kind of connection with Aisling is a potential suspect.
I'm not going to insult your intelligence by trying to claim you're the exception.
Rory must have known, but it still lights him up with fear.
I never even saw her last night, and I cared about her. I thought we were going to... Why would I...
Whatever he was thinking about telling us is gone.
Fair enough, Steve says reasonably. But we have to figure everyone we talk to is going to say the same thing. And one person's going to be lying. We'd be only delighted to eliminate you. The faster we narrow it down, the better. But we can't do it just on your word. You can see that, right?
Then how do you do it?
Evidence. We always need fingerprints. And on this case, we're also asking for coats and gloves. Obviously, I can't tell you why, but they should go a long way towards crossing you off our list.
You're all right with that, yeah?
We can hang on to those. Steve nods at Rory's gear.
Rory's taken aback, but Steve hasn't left him much choice.
I guess. I mean, yes. Okay. I'll get them back, right?
Course, Steve says, reaching across the table to hook the gloves across with his pen.
It might take a few days, just, okay, if we have a look in your apartment for any others that we might need to eliminate.
I'm not.
Rory blinks fast. The strain and the airless room are getting to him. He's starting to have a hard time keeping up.
Can't you just take these? They're the ones I was wearing last night, if that's...
See, though, Steve explains, we're not just trying to take this particular coat off our list. We're trying to take you off our list.
That means we need anything you could have worn, not just what you did wear. See what I mean?
Rory pushes up his glasses to press his fingers into the corners of his eyes.
Yes. Okay. Whatever you need. I'd rather be there, though, when you're in my apartment. I don't like this hot of people. Is that all right?
Not a problem, Steve says easily. The lads who bring you home can just take a quick look around while they're at it.
We'll get on that as fast as we can, yeah?
Get your prints done and get you out of here. Back to your day.
Rory's eyes close against his fingertips.
Yes, he says. I'd like that very much.
I toss Rory's gloves and his coat into evidence bags and head off to send them to Sophie before he can change his mind. Then I type up his statement and ignore the squad room turds ignoring me, while Steve prints off a map so Rory can draw us his route home as near as he can remember, or wants to, and takes him through his story one more time. I give the two of them as much alone time as we can afford, in case Rory's still holding a grudge against me. But when I come back into the interview room, Steve throws me a minuscule shake of his head.
Nothing interesting has happened.
Here, Rory says, pushing the map across the table.
He's looking rough. His lips are parched and the mousy hair is plastered flat to his head, like he's been running in heat. Is that okay? There's a careful line winding from Stony Batter to Ranelagh, and a tiny tidy X labelled flowers on the keys.
That's great, Steve says. Thanks a million.
Have a read of that, I say, holding out the statement and a pen. If it's all correct, initial every page and then sign at the end.
Rory doesn't move to take the statement.
Do you think? He catches a long breath. If I hadn't left when I did, if I kept banging on the door, or if I'd called the police, or if I'd broken in, would I have been able to save her?
I almost say yes. If he's not our guy, he's such a god-awful damp weenie.
The kind who needs regular slaps across the back of the head just to keep him from vanishing up his own hole.
Plus, he just wasted half our day by being in the wrong place looking guilty as hell.
All I have to do is say yes, and he'll spend the rest of his life whipping himself with a more and more elaborate fantasy where he storms into that cottage in the nick of time and saves Aisling from a herd of rampaging bikers. And they live happily ever after and have 2.4 damp weenie kids. It's practically irresistible. But if he is our guy, he's no idiot. And he'll find a way to use any info I hand him.
No way to know, I say. Here. And I dump the statement under his nose.
He reads it, or at least he spends a while staring at each page. At the end, he signs like he barely remembers how. It's headed for 4 o'clock. We get hold of the floaters, who've been pulling CCTV footage, Kelleher and Riley, and tell them what we want done with Rory and his gaff. Steve finds an old hoodie in his locker, so Rory won't freeze his delicate self on the way home. Then we tell him how great he is and hand him over.
You owe me a tenner, Steve says, as we watch Kelleher and Riley walk him down the corridor. From the back, sandwiched between their farmer shoulders and their cop walks, Rory looks like a nerd being marched behind the school to get a few slaps. I check that I've got all the statement pages.
Like fuck I do. Did you not see him bawling his eyes out there?
Pay up.
Doesn't count. It has to be because he's petrified of us, not because he just found out his girlfriend died.
Since when?
Steve is right, but I feel like yanking his chain.
Nah. You can't make up the rules to suit.
Since always. When did I ever try to get away with... When did I ever try to stiff you just because I didn't like the timing of...
Rory and the floaters are gone, in a jumble of footsteps echoing down the marble stairwell. I slam the interview room door, and we head for the squad room to get our stuff together. The corridor still feels like it's twitching with covered pits and pointed sticks. But that doesn't feel like such a bad thing. Not anymore.
Chapter 5. I used to love the first case meeting. Love everything about it. The pulse of the instant room. Everyone taught as greyhounds at the traps. In that room, every answer comes in closer on top of the question. Every glance snaps around faster. The whip crack of the jobs being assigned. Murphy, collect the CCTV footage. Vincent, check gold Toyota Camrys. O'Leary, talk to the girlfriend. Bam, bam, bam. The moment when I'd shut my notebook and say, go. And we'd all be out for our seats and halfway to the door before my mouth closed on the word. I used to come out of that meeting feeling like the bastard we were after didn't have a chance in hell. By this time, even the thought of it, floaters eyeing me up and down, wondering which of the rumours are true. Me eyeing them back, wondering which of them is going to glom onto any slip-up. Blow it up huge and barter it for a laugh and a pat on the back.
turns me hangover queasy and hangover mean. Incident room C, but I haven't been in there since I was a floater, chasing down pointless non-leads for the big boys. I'd forgotten. The white light exploding down from the high ceiling, skating and flashing on the whiteboard and the tall windows. The sleek computers lined up straining for action. The throb of them pumping at the air. The desks, polished till they look like you could slice your thumb open on the edges. One step through the doorway, and that room blows the fatigue off me like dust and recharges me till I spark static. Walk in there and you could solve Jack the Ripper. And this time, I'm no floater, there to jump when some big man snaps his fingers. This time, I'm the big woman, and every bit of this is all mine. Just for one second, that room blindsides me into loving the job. A hard, green, painful love, like it's growing from scratch all over again. Steve's lifted face, lips parted in a half smile, like a kid at the panto says he feels the same way. That's what smacks sense back into me. Steve falls arse over tip for anything beautiful, without bothering to think about how it got that way or why, or what's underneath. I don't. I slap my stack of paper onto the boss desk, the double-length one at the head of the room. Gentlemen, I say loud, let's get started. Who owns this? I whip a coffee mug off the desk and hold it up. Breslin is leaning against the whiteboard, holding court for Deasy and Staunton, the floaters who brought Rory in, and the pair we put on the door-to-door. A slight fidgety dark guy called Mean, who I've worked with before, and like, and a prissy-faced newbie called Gaffney, who I've seen around, and who's holding himself so straight that his suit looks like a prefect's uniform. Breslin, or more likely someone he was bossing around, has made a start on the whiteboard. Shots of Aisling, the crime scene, Rory, a map of Stonybatter, and set out a heavy hardback notebook for the Book of Jobs, where we keep a list of what needs doing and who's supposed to be doing it. We even have an electric kettle. That's mine, Gaffney says, bobbing forward to grab the mug and retreating fast, scarlet. Sorry about that. Mean? I toss him the notebook. Book of Jobs, yeah? He catches it and nods. Steve dumps his stuff beside mine and starts handing out photocopies. The initial call sheet, the uniforms report, Rory's statement. I head for the whiteboard and sketch out a fast timeline of last night. The floaters pick desks and settle fast. Chit-chat's over. The Vic, I say, tapping the photo of Aisling with my marker. Aisling Murray, 26, lived alone in Stonybatter, worked as a receptionist at a firm selling bathroom supplies to businesses. No criminal record. No calls to us. Assaulted yesterday evening in her home. Cooper's preliminary exam says she took a punch to the face and hit her head on the fireplace around. Texts on her phone narrow down the time to between 7:13 and 8:09. I move to Rory's photo. This guy here, Rory Fallon, he's been seeing her for a couple of months. He was due at her house for dinner at 8 o'clock. Stupid bastard, says DC, grinning.
Look her like her. He should have at least waited to kill her till after he got his hole.
Snickers. Breslin clears his throat with an indulgent smirk and a tilt of his head towards me. The snickers fade. I say, you can make it up to him, DC, seeing as it matters so much to you. Next time we bring him in, you go ahead and give him a blowjob in the jacks. DC pinches at his tash and makes a sour face. The snickers rise up again, prickly and equivocal. I say, me and Moran and Breslin, we've just had a chat with Fallon. His story is that he was at Aisling's door at 8, but she didn't answer. So he figured he'd been dumped
and flounced off home to cry in his pillow. Amazingly enough, Breslin drawls, twirling his pen, we don't believe him. Our working theory, I say, is that Fallon arrived at the Vic's place around 7:30. Things went bad somehow, and he punched her. We're guessing he thought she was just knocked out. He legged it home and hoped she wouldn't call the cops on him or wouldn't remember what happened. That has Breslin nodding along approvingly, giving the newbie's little theory his blessing. More like manslaughter than murder, he says. But that's not our problem. By early this morning, I say, either Fallon's conscience got to him, or else he'd talked to a mate who wanted to do the right thing. An anonymous Mayo caller reported to Stonybatter Station that there was a woman with head injuries at 26 Viking Gardens and requested an ambulance. My money's on Fallon doing it himself, Breslin says. He's exactly the type who'd bottle it after a few hours, start trying to put things right just when it's too late. The phone number came up private, Steve says. Who wants to get on it? All their hands shoot up. Easy there, boys, Breslin says, grinning. There's plenty to go round. Gaffney, you take the phone number, I say. I need to give the kid a pat, settle him after the mug thing. Mean writes that down. Staunton, DC, you are working on a list of Fallon's KAs. How's that going?
Nothing surprising, Staunton says. Mother, father, two older brothers, no sisters, handful of mates from school and college, a few ex-flatmates, long list of work colleagues and friends, mostly history teachers, librarians, that kind of thing. I'll email it on to you.
Do that. Detective Breslin, you've already started talking to the KAs, am I right? Both Fallon's brothers sounded appropriately shocked, Breslin says. According to them, they knew about Rory's big date, but that's as far as they got. They were waiting to hear all the dirty details. They claim they didn't ring Stonybatter Station this morning, or ever, but then they would, wouldn't they? I've got them both coming in for separate chats after this.
Breslin's planning on working a long shift for a bog-standard case.
If they don't pan out, keep working your way down the list, I say. Start with anyone who lives near Rory's route home, where he could have got a surprise visit last night. And while you're at it, get the brothers and the best mates on tape. We need to run their voices and Fallon's past the guy at Stonybatter who took the call, see if he recognises any of them. Can you follow that up?
For a second, I think Breslin's going to tell me to stick my scut work. But he says,
why not?
Although there's a twist to his mouth.
Great, I say. We need someone to go through CCTV. We'll put Kelleher and Riley down for that. They're pulling all the local footage they can get. They might as well watch it.
Me nods, writing.
And someone needs to pull footage from the northbound 39A bus route yesterday evening. Find the buses that stopped on Moorhampton Road around 7. See if you can pick out Rory Fallon getting on. Confirm what time he boarded and what time he got off in Stonybatter.
The gym rat has a finger up. That whip crack rhythm. The one I used to love. Even though I know better, it still hits me like a triple espresso.
Staunton's on that. And we need someone to head out to Stonybatter and time the route Rory says he took from the bus stop, down Astrid Road to the top of Viking Gardens, then up to Tesco on Prussia Street. Buy a bunch of flowers and head back down to Viking Gardens.
Mean, you're around the same build and age as Fallon. Can you do that?
Time it twice, once at your normal pace, once as fast as you can go.
Mean nods. Steve says, glancing back and forth between him and Gaffney. Did Rory's flower show up in the bins on the keys?
I looked,
Mean says. Gaffney kept going with the door to door. The bins hadn't been emptied since last night by the state of them, but no irises anywhere. Some lad probably robbed them to give to his board. Or, Breslin says, they were never in the bins at all. Rory boy tossed them in the river because he didn't want us pulling Aisling's blood or hair or carpet fibres off them. Where are we on her KAs? She didn't have any immediate family or much of a social life, I say. But her friend Lucy gave us a few names and numbers to start us off. Someone needs to go around to Aisling's workplace, get her boss to come in and ID the body and have the chats with all her colleagues. I want to know if she talked about Rory and what she said. Steve says, and we need to know if any of the colleagues had a thing for her, just on the off chance that Rory's telling the truth. Breslin snorts. Someone might not have been happy that Aisling had got herself a fella, and her colleagues were the only people she spent any amount of time with. Nice touch. If anyone spots us doing something that doesn't point to Rory, we've got a potential stalker colleague to take the heat. It might even turn out to be true.
Why don't you two cover the office romance? Breslin says. Feminine intuition and all that jazz.
Mine's in the shop, I say. Transmission went. We'll just have to go with actual detective work. DC, Staunton, you head over there first thing tomorrow. The other place Aisling spent time was at evening classes, Steve says. She could have picked up a stalker there. We need someone to work out what classes she took, make lists of all the other students, or whatever they call them. Gaffney, you take that, I say. Me and Moran will handle Aisling's phone records, emails, social media, all that.
I can make a start on that tonight, Breslin says. I don't mind staying a few hours late if that'll help put this case to bed. But I can't exactly show up at Rory's KA's houses at 9 in the evening looking for chats. I might as well get cracking on the Vic's social life.
My look clicks against Steve's for a split second before his head goes down over his notebook. Breslin could just be trying to buff up his stellar rep. Everyone always wants the Vic's electronics because more often than not, there's something good in there. Or he could be looking to make me into the loser who couldn't find her own evidence, or he could need to get rid of anything in there that points to a gangster pal. Mean has stopped writing and is looking back and forth between us, uncertain.
Me and Moran have already started on it, I say. We've been in since last night and we need to catch a few hours kip, but we'll get back on to Aisling's electronics first thing tomorrow morning.
You've started on Rory Fallon. Detective Breslin, you might as well stick with him. We need someone to make a list of his exes and see what they've got to say about him. Especially about what winds him up and what he's like when he doesn't get his way. If you can stay late tonight, why don't you get the ball rolling on that?
Breslin has on a face like he's found a hair in his soup and knows the waiter is too useless to fix it. Why don't I do that?
Great, I say. After a moment, Mean's pen starts moving again. Detective Gaffney, first murder case, am I right?
It is, yeah.
He's from somewhere involving sheep.
Okay, I say. Sending the gaffer a mental thank you for not bothering to get us floaters with actual experience.
You stick close to Detective Breslin for now. He'll show you the ropes. Help you get the hang of this.
Breslin nods pleasantly at Gaffney. No objections. But that means nothing.
Can you stay a bit late tonight, yeah?
Gaffney sits up even straighter.
I can, of course.
Anyone who can't?
No one moves.
Good. We need someone to pull Aisling's financials. Gaffney, start on that. You'll need to go through them anyway for her evening class payments.
Breslin sighs. just loud enough to make it clear that I'm wasting valuable time and resources. Steve says to everyone, "We don't have a motive yet. The romance gone bad is the obvious one, but we can't rule out a financial angle. Rory mentioned that his bookshop's been having a hard time, and Aisling's mate Lucy Reardon said she had a bit of cash stashed away. Rory could have asked her to put a few grand into the bookshop and got nasty when she turned him down. Something like that." Breslin shrugs. He started doodling on the corner of his notebook. "We'll need Rory's financials too," I say. "Gaffney, pull those while you're at it. Someone needs to get onto the phone company and start them tracking where Fallon's phone went last night. DC, got a decent contact at Vodafone? Someone to confirm Lucy Reardon's alibi with the rest of the staff at the Torch Theatre. Staunton, you handle that. Someone to talk to the staff at the Market Bar and Pestle. See if they can tell us anything about Aisling and Rory's dates. Mean, yeah? Someone to assign one of the uniforms from the scene to go to the autopsy. DC, you do that. It'll be early tomorrow morning. Make sure he's not late, or Cooper will throw a shit fit." Snorts from everyone who's met Cooper. Me and Morn will follow up with the text, make sure we're kept updated. There'll be more, but those should get us started. Any questions? Head shakes. They're fidgeting at the starting line. "Okay," I say. "Let's go." Meehan claps the book of jobs shut. They swing to their desks, their phones, to Rory's statement, diving to see who can hit the ground running fastest. Incident Room C leaps with the energy ricocheting off the shining rows of desks splintering on the windows. And underneath all that, hidden and working away, the small, ferocious buzzing of the thing at the back of my mind and Steve's, nudging for us to let it loose. Breslin's slick, fair hair is bent over his notebook, but when he feels me looking, he glances up and gives me a great big smile. Steve types up a report for the gaffer while I go through the stuff the floaters brought back. They're all competent enough, although DC can't spell, and Gaffney feels the need to share every detail of everything, relevant or not. Witness advised that she was taking her daughter, Ava, aged 8, to visit her grandfather in St. James's Hospital after severe stroke and saw Murray getting out of car. Nothing particularly interesting in the door-to-door. Aisling was friendly with her neighbours. No bad blood over noise or parking spaces, nothing like that. But not close to any of them. A few of them saw a woman, matching Lucy's description, going into or out of her house now and then. None of them ever saw any other visitors. Aisling never mentioned a boyfriend. They saw her going out semi-regularly in the evenings, all dolled up, but they weren't on gossip-swapping terms and they have no idea where she was heading or what she did there. The old couple in number 24 are half deaf and heard nothing last night. The young couple in number 28 heard Aisling blasting her Beyonce, but they say she turned the music either down or off a little before 8. They could pinpoint it because 8 is the baby's bedtime, so they appreciated the volume control. After that, not a sound. The old fella in number 3 backs Rory's story, or bits of it. He was heading out to walk his dog, a white male terrier named Harold, according to Gaffney, just before 8 o'clock last night. And he saw a guy, matching Rory's description, turning into Viking Gardens. When he got back, 15 minutes later, the guy was still there, down at the bottom of the road, messing about with his phone. None of the other neighbours were outside in those 15 minutes. Viking Gardens is mostly old people and a few young families. No one heading out on the Saturday night batter. Which means Rory could have been let into the house, killed Aisling, and been back outside texting up a cover story by 8:10. But I don't buy it. The part that turned him twitchy was earlier, before the Tesco side trip. None of the neighbours were out in the road then to see him or not. Steve is still typing. Breslin's headed off for his chats with Rory's brothers, taking Gaffney with him and dispensing wisdom all the way. Mean has buttoned his overcoat to the neck and gone off to time himself wandering around Stonybatter. Deasy's having a laugh with his contact at the phone company. Staunton's laying down the law to someone from the buses. Their voices wander around the high corners of the room, turning blurry at the edges from too much space. The windows are dark. My phone rings.